Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Dan Truchewski, Program Chair of the Club and Science of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Chenmeng Calvin Hu, Distinguished Professor of Microelectronics in the Graduate School at UC at the University of California at Berkeley. Let me just take a few moments here to introduce Dr. Hu. Dr. Chenmeng Hu has been called the father of 3D transistors for developing FinFET in 1999. The IEEE, the Institute for Electrical and Electronics Engineers, has called Professor Hu a microelectronics visionary. He's well known for leading the development of BSIM and FinFET. BSIM is the first international standard MOSFET model and has been used by IC, or Integrated Circuit Corporations, worldwide to design ICs worth hundreds of billions of dollars since 1997. FinFET, the 3D transistor, has been used in IC production since 2011, firstly by Intel, and they have actually called it the most radical shift in semiconductor technology in over 50 years. Needless to say, Professor Hu has received many professional awards. Most recently, he is going to receive the Phil Kaufman Award for 2013. He is involved in many things. Dr. Hu is a board member of SanDisk Corporation. He also was the chief, from 2001 to 2004, he was the chief technology officer at Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, which is the world's largest dedicated integrated circuits manufacturing company. He's also on the board of a nonprofit's Friends of Children with Special Needs, and he also was the board chairman of the nonprofit East Bay Chinese School in Oakland, California. He's authored many books. He has over 900 research papers, and he's been granted over 100 patents. He's been honored with membership in three national academies, the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and the Academia Sinica. He's a fellow of IEEE. He's been very interested in the education of young people, young students at universities, and he's also, as a result of his interest and as a result of his teaching abilities, has been honored by receiving the highest award for teaching at University of California, Berkeley, the Berkeley Distinguished Teaching Award. He's currently researching the Green Tunnel GFET transistor for ultra-low power electronics. Let me just finish off by saying Dr. Hu has obtained his graduate degrees in engineering, in electrical engineering at UC Berkeley. Dr. Hu.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It is really my pleasure to share with you some recent important development in the semiconductor technology area and use that as a way to illustrate a thesis that is semiconductor technology still have a bright long future, and however it will rely more heavily on older and bigger innovations. Now this is not a trivial statement, because perhaps not widely known secret of the semiconductor technology is that its formula for success has been incrementalism. That is, don't fix it until it breaks. But you probably have heard in the past dozen years that Moore's law is ending, the technology is going to stop, and indeed that is all true if we did not bring bigger, bolder ideas to the table. But I think there are still bigger ideas to come, and that is good news for the world, for the consumers. I think we will continue to see good things coming from this technology. As Daniel mentioned, in 2011, New York Times had this front page news saying that Intel will use 3D FinFET, and co-founder Gordon Moore was quoted of saying that this is the most radical change in the semiconductor technology in over 40 years, which is the history of the technology we're using. Now, why is the industry willing to take this much bigger than usual step? Well, it is because there are several things that is happening. Well, one is that it's harder to make the chips smaller. And making chips smaller, indeed, is one way of, important way of keeping the cost down and increasing the functions of the chips and the electronics. Now, FinFET is spelled F-I-N-F-E-T. Now, F-E-T just means transistors. So the name is Fin transistor. I gave this transistor this name because the transistor looks like the back fin of fish. So if you visualize, electron microscope pictures of FinFET-based circuits, you're going to find little pieces of semiconductors sticking up like the back fin of fish. And this is what the future transistor is going to be like, and that's why I call that FinFET. Now, what's good about FinFET? What's the reason for this to be really the hottest topic in the technology, semiconductor technology in the last few years? At a very, basic level, just when you think about this fin shape, and also the description, it's a three-dimension. You probably conjure an image and will not be totally wrong to think that what we are talking about is a situation where a congested city is looking for room to grow, and in addition to making the rooms smaller, it decides to build multi-story buildings, building up. So in a way, it's not wrong, although this is a promise of FinFET that's actually not getting the industry most excited initially. In the future, we'll probably will take more advantage of that third dimension. But more immediately, the industry is dealing with a bigger problem. What people really were worried about in the last 15 years, thinking that end may be near, is really the fact that the chips are using more and more energy and getting the chips hotter. And very reputable companies and researchers have forecasted not long ago that the microchips are going to dissipate as much power, watt per centimeter square per unit, as the nuclear reactor cores and the nozzle of a rocket. Of course, it's not going to happen. But it gives an indication of how scared people were. And so FinFET actually immediately gives some relief about this energy usage. Actually, this problem with energy usage is not independent of the size issue I mentioned earlier. It's because we're trying to make the transistor smaller and smaller
you know, not knowing anything about a transistor, I think a person probably can imagine if you put anything too close, it's going to be very hard to avoid the current flowing between them. And that's called a leakage, and leakage is a problem. And maybe another way to think about leakage issues is that think of a transistor as like a piece of garden hose that may be lying on a soggy lawn in the backyard. And the water flows through the hose. You can turn off the water flow by pressing on the hose, trying to shut that off. When the piece of hose is long, you may be able to do that with a hand or even two hands. But imagine if the hose gets very small. How can you do that? And this is the picture of the traditional semiconductor that have served us very well in the last 50 years was based on and is facing that problem. You know, if you think about it, it really has to do with the fact that this for example, there's no firm ground on which for you to even press down on that hose. Those are the problems. And a FinFET is a way to change the situation in a very sort of layman's view of thinking about it would be to say, all right, let's make this hose a flat hose, much thinner flat hose. And not only that, you're not going to try to pinch it off by pressing on a soft ground. You're going to stand it up and pinch it off with both fingers or two fingers or something, like you're trying to then you will be able to do that better and turn the electricity off. So that's a general idea about what FinFET does. It's a power issue. Now, what's good about making an innovation at a transistor level is the following. Although there are, you know, probably tens of thousands of companies providing us with electronics we see every day, you know, at home, at work, for entertainment, medicine, whatever. But if you look into the microchip, any of this company does, or any manufacturer is responsible for manufacturing this chip, regardless of that, all these chips use basically exactly the same transistor. And not only that, it hasn't changed much for decades because of the incrementalism I mentioned about. So if we can make a big change at the transistor level, automatically the benefits will propagate throughout the electronics world, and that is what's really exciting about this news. If we think about what a transistor does, the simplest way to think about that, one I mentioned, is think of it as a piece of hose, and water is the current, electrical current is the water flowing through the hose, and you try to pinch it off or not pinch it off, that's the on and off. And another way to think of, of course, is an electrical switch, just like the ones that we flip on as we enter a room to turn on the lights. And that's really what a transistor is. It's really an on-off switch. Now, a switch, of course, doesn't give us as much room for imagination about how big a problem leakage can cause. But indeed, it's a big, big problem because we're trying to make this electrical switch so, so small. Right? And in fact, they are not much larger than tens of atoms. I'm not exaggerating. That's how big they are. They're only of the width of a few tens of atoms. And pretty soon, in fact, it's getting to the single digit of atoms. I'll tell you, an atom of silicon is about three. So we're talking about tens of atoms is the size. Now, how can a simple thing like a switch do all the fantastic things for electronics? That is, the trick is very simple. That is, we take advantage of the huge number of these very simple things. So each transistor can only carry on a very simple function, off and on. That's a little oversimplification, but it's all right, I think, for this discussion. But if you have enough of that, make them do each do very simple things, actually it turns out you can do fantastic things. In some, to some way, it's actually not that different from how the brain works. Just use a huge number of simple things, but the key here is to be able to make these things work at very small size and be able to manufacture them at a good cost, high yield, reliability. So it's a fantastic technology. Now, the manufacturing side of the industry has been indeed been able to make things smaller, roughly, particularly in the recent past, even more so than the farther past. The industry has been able to pack twice the number of the transistors into the same chip size every 2 years and make it for about the same price. No, roughly, this is about it. And this is the amazing thing. And it's because of this, in the last 40, 50 years, you know, think this, the price per transistor really has dropped down by more than 100 million times, close to a billion times. And the speed has increased by more than a million, 10 million times. And so with that, of course, can do a lot of fantastic things. In looking at your cell phone today, a smartphone that we carry in our pocket, just each one phone actually has more computing power than all the computers that existed before the days of microchip in the world combined had. And now we just, everyone can carry sometimes more than one in the pocket. And that's not the end of it, right? Think about the memory. You know, each cell phone can carry as much memory as necessary to encode the information in all the books in a university library. You know, this is all true. And we have not yet touched on the communication capability, which is totally different from computing, right? How do you get that small signal from the air to get the cell phone signal or from the hi-fi signal from the wireless router? And how do you deal with the noise? How do you do the filtering? And all this is are done by the transistors. And you know, even the fantastic camera, even that camera is made by the same CMOS technology we're talking about. So this one-trick pony really, it's taking us far and can still take us farther. And so this is how the transistor does it, by taking advantage of the fact there are so many of them, and even though each of them is given a very simple task, together they do this very well. So a little closer, a more, I guess, technical view of the transistor would be, you want to think about transistors being made of semiconductor, and the semiconductor, really only the surface is at play. At least this is the way I have learned about semiconductor, and I had taught my students many years, that we're really talking about just a surface transistor. You only need to think about a surface, and the current flows on the surface, and we can control this current flow by another conductor that is separated from the surface by a very thin layer of insulators. A voltage on this control terminal can then turn off the current flow or turn on the current flow. And in that picture, we had taught our students that what we need to do is to make that insulator thinner and thinner. As long as you keep making the insulator thin, we can make our transistor smaller and smaller without any problem. We can always turn off that transistor. But, you know, in the 90s, I began to, you know, understand much better that actually the worst part of the transistor as far as leakage is concerned is not a surface. Because surface is close enough to the gate through the thin insulator, indeed, is well controlled by the control voltage. But what about some locations that even just 100 atoms below the interface? Now there, the control of the control signal is not going to be strong regardless of how thin that insulator is, right? Because you're talking about leakage passes far from it. This is the problem of a fat big hose, right? So you have to make that hose thinner. That's the idea. And there were other things, other people were looking at, but I just felt they're not going to cut it. It's not bold enough. They're going to be work, but at some point it will not work. And I felt that the only way of doing it is to eliminate the semiconductor, eliminate the silicon from everywhere that is not very close to the gate. In other words, we can only allow, let's say, 150 atoms of, or just 100 atoms of silicon, that thickness. Very thin layer of a semiconductor. That's all we can do. Now, it so happens that about this time, 1996, DARPA, the government Defense Advanced Research Project agency that also was instrumental to develop the internet technology and some other good things, they send out a request for proposal. I remember very well the proposal's name is 25 nanometer switches. Now, there are interesting information contained in this words, 25 nanometer. That is the most optimistic technologies in the world at that time thought was possible. And probably majority technologists thought we would never go down to beyond 100 nanometer. But most optimistic person would say, yeah, we can probably get to 25 nanometer. And beyond that, of course, is DARPA's job to figure out some way to go beyond what's possible. So that's 25 nanometer. And the call for proposal did not call this 25 nanometer transistor. It called 25 nanometer switches. And I really believed that DARPA had in mind that the winning proposal would be something like molecular switch or something, because that's what we academics were all talking about. And however, I did have this idea that it can be done. And the idea is that you have to figure out how to make transistors in a thin film. Now, if you imagine if you had a high-quality semiconductor film, the film is only, it's very thin, let's say, and you put this dielectric over and under this film on both sides of the film and put that control electrode on both sides of the film and make the control electrode align to, these two align to each other. Now, that will satisfy the goal that there's no current leakage pass that is far from the gate, because we start with film. It's very thin. If it's thin enough, of course, there will be no leakage path that will be far from one or the other gate, right? The problem is that we don't know how to make such a film, because we want to make transistors in very, very high quality single crystalline material. And the only way we know how to make that material is in a form called silicon wafer. They're 12-inch, like about the size of a large pizza, only 1 millimeter in thickness, and the quality is excellent. But 1 millimeter is like soggy long. It just gives us too much leakage path. So how do we turn this into 100 or 50 atom size? Actually, I think I have to even think about it. Are we really talking about... we're talking about, about 40 silicon atom thickness film and a perfect crystal quality, better than the best quality diamond, really. I'm not exaggerating. That's how good this silicon quality is. How do we make a thin film like that? And that's where I propose this idea. Don't think this way. Think that thin film is turned around sitting on its end, like thin fins. Now, because this industry knows very well how to make small features. That's what we know. We knew that already in the 90s, how to make them small features. So why don't we use a lithographic method to create the patterns that are thin, and then use etching to etch the thin things into the high-quality millimeter-thick wafer. So the millimeter-thick wafer is still there, providing mechanical support for the chip. But what we used to think is the surface we want, now we make them little things. It's the thin surface that we're going to use. Right? So this is how we're going to get more usable surfaces, and this will help us pack more transistors in without having to use larger chips and increasing cost. And this will also allow us to turn off the current by pinching on the two sides of a flat thing. So this is the general idea that we had. And so we were granted research grants. And I led a small group of colleagues and the students. And by 1999, we were able to publish astounding result of using this concept to make transistors. It's way beyond what people thought was possible. And so the idea was very quickly recognized as a good one. Intel, for example, invited me to visit three times in the next 12 months after this publication, and other companies did this as well. So then the question became, when will it go into production? Now, this is where what I said earlier comes in, incrementalism, right? You don't want to do things before you really have to do it. I was asked by the media at that time, you know, how long is this going to happen? I said, about a dozen years, so it's about right. And so this is the time then the semiconductor industry is moving into that. You know, knowing the principle of a solution is truly important. So although our paper describes some result which was astounding, but I think more important is that we pointed out a way to keep this going for many generations of technology, and that we call a scaling path. The scaling path is that we cannot and should not rely on reducing that dielectric insulator thickness as a scaling path. For one, we're not going to have much opportunity to reduce the dielectric thickness. It's already only a few layers of atom in thick in the dielectric thickness. I'm talking about the silicon dioxide. And in any event, that's not a necessary thing anyway. And it's also not sufficient because, as I said, thin dielectric only deals with the surface, but the problem is not at the surface, it's deeper. So the new scaling path is going to be making this thing thinner. In other words, making using thinner and thinner thing. And that people do see they can go quite a few generations onward. And so that is a good news. Because of that, this concept that we can go on further. So soon after the 1999 paper, many companies try harder to make that thing thinner using better equipment. And so in 2002, AMD showed 10 nanometer FinFET, and 2004, TSMC showed 5 nanometer FinFET, and now the record is 3 nanometer FinFET. And that, by the way, no one even is thinking that we'll ever use this because it's too hard to imagine how we're going to go over there. But the point is that this physics barrier at least has been overcome. We do see a way to go there if equipment manufacturers and everything can be put together. Then there's a lot, long way to go. So this is about the transistor and manufacturing level. I want to make a little connection between this and the circuits. I mentioned the transistor, each of them only does a very simple function, but you have to connect hundreds of millions, if not billions of these on a chip to really make them work very well. And by the way, you know, a large processor uses about a couple billions of transistors with a B. And a memory, a NAND flash memory, has over 100 billion of transistors on one chip. And every year, this industry is making several billion transistors for every man, woman, and child. And they're still left over for the family dogs and the cats. I don't know what the dogs and cats will use transistor for, but there are plenty for them there. So who puts these individual transistors, connect them together into circuits? This is the job of the circuit designers. And circuit designers uses computers to do this design. Nobody use soldering iron to connect transistors together to do this. But how does the designer know the detailed behaviors of this transistor? As I mentioned earlier, transistors, although we like it to be a switch, it's not a simple switch. It's actually pretty complex now. So with this complex design, physics in there, and the complexity, even imperfections introduced by the manufacturing process, the transistor is a very complicated thing, even single transistor. So what's needed to connect the circuit design versus with the transistor physics and manufacturing is a computer model. This model is just a set of mathematical equations and functions, actually, that is accurate enough to capture every detail of the transistor so that the designer, circuit designer, can rely on that and design a complex chip and expect this chip to work the first time it comes out of the fab. And this is actually what's happening today. So the computer has, the model has to be very accurate. Now, I'm very happy to say that not only we had the honor of developing this FinFET at university, but actually UC Berkeley has also been the university that provides the model to enable the design. And specifically, the Berkeley FinFET model was selected as industry standard in 2012 by the industry consortium. So I'm very happy to see this happen. This is not the first time. In fact, I have been leading with my student for 20 years now to provide the models to the industry. And in 1996, the Berkeley transistor model, not for FinFET, of course, for the transistor at that time, was selected as the industry's very first standard model. Before that time, every company has its own proprietary model. And there were over hundreds of those. In fact, sometimes in one large company, there are several models. Just because, you know, I'm designing a circuit, I don't think these models are good enough. I'll write one myself. And starting in 1996, that has changed. And this really has increased the efficiency of the industry a lot. And particularly the way the design companies work with the foundries. For example, Apple designs their processor, but they don't manufacture it. So they have nothing to do with the design of the transistor or with the way it's made. But they take this model from, let's say, Samsung, and that is all their designer need to do. And I'm happy to say that UC has been providing this model. It has been used to design over $1 trillion worth of integrated circuit. And this is the example. By example, you know, these models just have to match all kind of variations of size and input-output voltage, RF behavior, radio frequency behavior, and analog and digital behavior, temperature variation. So what really is based on the physics to capture that. I'm excited about this model, of course, because not only it's accurate, it also has to be very fast. It has to be fast enough for you to use this model to represent each and every one of millions of transistors at the same time and still get a result out in any reasonable speed for the designers to make use of it. So this is quite an interesting model. So let me circle back to this question of energy. You know, at a university, especially a university like Berkeley, which is very socially minded, you know, we don't like to think that we work for particular companies' problems. We like to work for society's problems. So while heat management is something of grave concern for the companies, we actually look a little farther. We think that it's actually a world energy consumption problem. You know, today the energy used by the data centers alone is about 2% of the U.S. electricity. All the electricity of the U.S. consumption, 2% is in data center alone. Now, if you add this on to all the energy used for the laptops, home computers in the industry and everywhere that connects to the data centers, it's probably, you know, quite a few percent. No one has that number. Now, what's scary to me about this number is the following, is that everything about this technology, semiconductor, doubles every few years. Everything. The number of chips sold, the number of transistors on the chip, and all that. Now, when energy doubles, this percentage doubles every few years, doesn't matter too much when that percent is 0.1%. When we get to a few percent, that's what we call the inflection point. Now we're talking about serious energy. So we really think this is going to be the showstopper for this industry if we do not do something big about that. Now, FinFET does take one step in that direction, but it actually is not big enough step to really solve that problem. What we really want to do is we want to reduce the power by 100 times. Now, it's not impossible. The principle is that if we want to reduce the power consumption by 100 times, all we have to do is reduce the voltage used to drive these chips by 10 times. There's a power law relationship. Now, why can we not use 10 times smaller voltage today? Why do we have to? Why are we stuck with the voltage we're using today? Well, it turns out that's because of the transistor. The transistor, as we know, cannot work well at lower voltage. FinFET allows it to work better at a little lower voltage, but not 10 times lower. So we need something that truly is revolutionary. But there are ideas out there, and these are the three major ideas, and professors in my university are working on all three of these because it's not clear which one will be the winner. One would be a mechanical switch. So this is going back to the analogy of the switch that we flip on as we enter the room. You know, can we make this mechanical switch as small as that? And another one is use the quantum mechanical tunneling mechanism rather than controlling the current with a potential barrier for the electron flow. We let this electron tunnel through a tunnel, but use electrical signal to modulate the width of the tunnel. And that's another way that we see can eventually, in principle, get us to that 100 times lower energy consumption. And then finally, I'll mention the invention of a young colleague, Saïd Salahuddin. He calls this a negative capacitance transistor, which uses a new a ferroelectric material in a new way. And so these are the possibilities, and we're all working on that. Another big innovation will be not building circuits, just one layer of circuits on the chip and then sell it, but start to build many, many layers of circuits and put in one package and do this in a way that's cheap. And it's possible the first thing that will take advantage of this will be the flash memory. SanDisk have announced, and so has other companies, that in a couple of years, we probably will see this kind of memories. They're going to have not even two or three layer of circuits instead of today's one, but we're going to have 16 or 32 of those. If you want to do it, you have to do this big. This is, I think I will stop here. And thank you for your attention. The idea is that this technology that has taken the world far will take us even farther. The difference is that it's going to start to use bolder innovations, bigger changes, simply because the incremental changes is not going to be enough. And I think it's a good news for the consumers. I think we can still expect more and better electronics to come. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Professor Hu for his comments here today. And I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. And you are listening to Microchips and Electronics. Can they continue to do more for and with less? By distinguished Professor Chenning Calvin Hu of the University of California at Berkeley. Now we'll open the floor to questions and answers. We do have a microphone that we can, maybe the room is small enough that we can all hear. If not, we'll get a microphone sent around the room.
Actually, the microphone is a standing microphone.
Oh, you do have a standing microphone?
No, I'm fine. Sorry. Oh, there. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Aside from UC Berkeley, you mentioned the other major research facilities in the world that are working on this technology?
They are, the question is about other research laboratories. If we're talking about FinFET, since that's where most of time was spent in my talk, that today is actually the main topic for new technology at, I believe, all the advanced semiconductor companies. You know, whether you're doing design or doing manufacturing, Apple, Samsung, IBM, Qualcomm, TSMC, every advanced companies that is are working on this. And by 2014, I believe you know, most of these companies will be using it. So we're really talking about things that's happening.
Just a few very quick questions. First of all, how rapidly do you expect FinFET to be adopted? Like, perhaps what percentage of CPUs will be using it in, oh, I don't know, 5 years? Secondly, how is it going to impact Moore's Law? Will it allow us to stay on the same curve? Will it allow us to advance it? Or will it still decline? And then the third question is, what's the role of alternatives to silicon, and how rapidly can we see them adopted, over what and over what time frame?
Okay. A couple of questions. I'll take them one by one. The rate of adoption. Now, Intel at this point is using it for 22-nanometer production. That is their 22-nanometer technology. And companies that will come after that will not do this at 20 nanometer. They're going to frog jump to the next generation. Some call the 16 nanometer. You know, the name, you know, is hard to decipher somehow. But basically, the next new generation from advanced companies will be FinFET. And how long will a new generation of technology become the main technology supporting the processor? Now, typically, there is about a 2-3 year delay for the processor. It does not take very long, so this learning curve rises pretty fast. It does not mean that the older technology will suddenly disappear. It will continue to go on, but for every node of technology, there's going to be a rise and then a decline. So in 3 years, FinFET already will be in very high volume, if not peak, of the production. And then at that time, the next generation will come out also using FinFET. And after 2 or 3 years, another generation will come, I believe, also using FinFET. So that's the idea. But in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see the impact of that. Servers first. You're going to see servers all using FinFET very soon. The silicon is one question. When would this replace silicon? Now, FinFET is material agnostic. It can work with silicon as semiconductor or can work with another semiconductor. Today, the microchips are all made on semiconductor, basically no exception, basically. However, it is a good question that leads to this one thing I probably should have mentioned as the another big change that's coming along. Is it appears a very large change, there will be change in material. Silicon will still be our substrate, will play many roles in it, but we probably also have some thin films of other semiconductors. People are talking about germanium, talking about indium, or 3-5 compound semiconductors, and farther along in the future, I'm very excited about something called a two-dimensional crystalline semiconductor. And so these we're probably still talking about some years away, but probably less than 10 years away, there will be materials that will eclipse silicon.
And then what do you take that
Moore's law? What does FinFET do to the Moore's law? Moore's law is a empirical law that says the number of transistors on a wafer doubles every 2 or 3 years. Okay. If FinFET wasn't used, then this Moore's law was expected to really slow down, and that's why has been talked about for almost a dozen years. Moore's law is going to be run into trouble. But with the FinFET, people are very comfortable. In fact, they are now racing to introduce the next generation FinFET technology. So there's absolutely no sign of slowing down right now. However, although FinFET solves the leakage physics problem, allowing the transistor to go down as small as I mentioned, some university did that even for 3 nanometer, manufacturing equipment is a problem. So that may still become a limiting factor someday, but no one wants to predict when that someday is. So I think it's safe to say that Moore's law cannot continue forever. Therefore, it will slow down. But it will not be the fault of FinFET.
You mentioned that when numbers grow large enough, exponential growth can create very large problems. The cost of each node is growing about 30 to 40% every couple of years, and we're now at a level where only 3 spenders are really spending at the leading edge. How does the increasing capital intensity of the semiconductor industry shape how you think innovation will play out in a field of fewer players investing?
The question is how will the recent consolidation of the big semiconductors who can really afford to spend big bucks to develop new technology. How does this trend affect what I think would happen, that is adoption and creation of bold new ideas? I personally think it actually will help for the following reason. When there were many players, no one wants to be the guy that spend the big bucks and end up having the benefit still shared by, you know, 100 other companies. Because it is a fact that one cannot protect the innovation perfectly. No matter how carefully you use patent and all that, people find turn around, because very often it's the idea that's important. And how do you implement an idea? Ideas cannot be patented, you know, theory, a concept cannot be patented. It's that implementation. But people find ways to get around that, and also just by knowing it can be done, already give the competitor a lot of incentives to spend money to do it, duplicate that. For this reason, it will be really hard if there are many companies around, and the nature of the business is always like that. When it starts to become very tough to go forward, the industry goes through consolidation. Consolidation now give these players bigger resources, and now they can see that their investment can be rewarded by that, because let's say if each company only has a $1 billion business and it will cost them $1 billion a year to do R&D, then of course they will not do that. But by through consolidation, they are all much larger companies now. So I think it's basically the only way for the industry to be able to take bigger steps rather than incremental steps. The other thing I would like to say, and this is maybe tooting the horn a little bit for universities in general, is that because it's so difficult for companies to protect their intellectual properties, the concept, that's what I mean, you know, not the shape of a phone, but it's because of this, there's always going to be reluctance for companies to do these investment far in advance. Because this kind of concept, once they come out, you're going to give your competitor a lot of time to catch up and to come to market at the same time as you. And this is the basically the reason the companies in the last, 30 years, starting with Bell Lab, it's been shrinking the horizon of their research investment. And especially in the U.S., something that has not happened in the history of university in the world is that in the last 20 years, universities has been given more of a trust by the industry to really do that pathfinding for them. So we are really set out to look for new ideas. And the companies will start to put in the important, large money that needed to make them reality. But universities are expected to look for these and do early demonstrations so that the companies have some assurance that they are not throwing huge money for something that may not turn out to may not work.
Thank you. My follow-up question is a very broad question. How do you think about the opportunity for innovation in the software level versus the hardware level? Thank you.
I'm not sure I'm qualified to say that, but I would just repeat what I hear my software colleagues at university say. They are hugely excited about what software can do. I need not even to say about application area, but thinking about the operating system area, architecture side, this parallelism, this multi-core, it's basically only at its infancy. the computer programming in the past really did not have a recognition of the concept of time. Right? Everything is just one line after another. You cannot do things in parallel. That concept was not even there from the day one of this concept of a programming a computer. So it's going to be a hugely rich area for innovation.
I have a question that relates to that, and that is, with everything getting so small, is it possible now to pack enough transistors in about the size of a container?
Is it possible to pack a computer into the size of a human skull?
Yes, the size of the brain pan, for instance.
I mean,
same density as neurons.
Yeah. If you look at the size of the neuron, it's actually a large computer transistor we're talking about. There are two differences. The neuron, however, has three-dimensional interconnection, right? So one thing people get excited about FinFET is, it's a three-dimensional in the sense you begin to take advantage of three-dimension. But still, the concept is one layer of these transistors. But at the very end of the talk, I did say that flash memory will be the first and logic will be later. We are contemplating, the industry is contemplating, starting to connect multiple layers of these transistors. But still, we're still talking about, a billion transistors in this one layer, but there are only, 100 layers. That's nothing like brain, right? It's going to be really, truly three-dimensional. So in terms of density, in that sense, we're far from it, and I don't even, cannot even imagine how we're going to get to that. On the other side, I like to say that I think there's limit to this idea of thinking brain being the ultimate model for what we want our electronics to do. Brain is great for certain things, but it's not very good for other things. Especially as I get older, I certainly know it's not very good memory, and I would not trust my brain to keep the accounts of millions of bank customers. So I'm not even sure that is the direction to think about. In other words, yes, we do want, we think the model is correct, that we're going to use very simple element, but large number of them to do very useful things. But if we want to pack them truly in three-dimensional ways, I'm afraid the simplicity we're going to demand on those elements will be so great that they're not going to be very reliable. So you have to tolerate that. If that is the kind of electronics we want, I think we can do it. But I'm not sure that is the model we're going to pursue. But it's a great intellectual challenge. It's going to be debates for decades to come whether that is the way we want to go. There are certainly many colleagues that are going exactly that way.
Our thanks to Professor Hu for his comments this evening. And we also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to our recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th anniversary of enlightened discussion is adjourned.